You seldom hear a conversation about Africa among economists that isn't about reforms. Lots of reforms in lots of sectors.
If I could pick one sector that's been worst affected by reformities, it's education in the region. Just too many reforms and programs all the time without really much to show for it.
So what are we missing? Why are effective reforms so hard to implement? In this episode, we hear a conversation about just that, with two people who look at reforms from two different perspectives. Ken Opalo is a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He's also the author of Legislative Development in Africa and a widely read blogger on African issues. In today's program, Opalo sits down with Ababe Amro Selassie, director of the IMF's African Department. This conversation is part of a series of talks with leading experts on African issues called Africa Perspectives. This is a slightly abridged version of their talk. You can watch a webcast of the entire event at imf.org.
So, to start our discussion, you know, this term reform often implies the need for change to improve policies or institutions because current arrangements are inadequate to what's needed. You've written a recent blog post, basically, advising practitioners to stop always going for the first best policies and accept that trade-offs are sometimes unavoidable. What do you see as the barriers to implementing reforms and how they can be overcome?
So that's a great and big question. I think the big background condition that we should always have in mind when we're thinking about reforms in the region is the fact that state capacity in the region remains weak, right? So state capacity then limits the extent to which governments can move nimbly in a reform direction. So that even whenever there's, and sorry to use this term, whenever there's political will, often, you know, the mechanisms of change may not be as adequate as needed to move in the right direction. So that's the big background condition. The second major point that we should always have in mind is that over the last 30 years or so, many African countries have adopted competitive politics. Whether they're, you know, full-fledged democracies or electoral democracies or electoral authoritarian states. They have electoral politics, which then means that alliance building and maintaining coalitions that sustain ruling coalitions is front of mind for many policymakers. So the confluence of these two factors mean that reform is not always easy. And unfortunately, as you noted at the beginning of your question, most of the time when we suggest reforms, we often fail to take seriously these two constraints, right? That states may not have the mechanisms to reform as quickly or as well as we would want them to. And two, that, you know, elites in power face real constraints that we should not just wish away, and that those constraints are actually a feature, not a bug, of the system. If we really care about institutions and strong institutions at that, if we want political accountability, right, that will mean that we have to go through the messy process of taking politics into account when we think about reform processes.
So to drill down on this issue a little bit, I guess the issue on politics needing to form coalition to gain power is something that's universal around the world. But perhaps what distinguishes our region is the weak institutional capacity that you highlighted. Can I ask, what do you see as the key constraint on state capacity?
I mean, I think, and you know, this may sound like a cop-out answer, but I think one of the biggest reasons is just history, right? Many states in the region are fairly young, right? 60 years as of today in most places. You know, in the long historical sort of time span that we should be thinking about, these are still fairly young states. And it, in some ways, it's remarkable that they still function the way they do given their age. But I think when it comes specifically to policymaking, I think one of the contributors to the challenges today is the sort of 20-year gap that we had beginning in the early 80s through the year 2000, in which I think policymakers went out of practice because the crisis forced them to step back in many ways and not you know, cultivate the same skill sets that we saw in the early post-colonial period. So if you look at most African states in the 60s and 70s, they're very ambitious. They're trying big things with very meager resources, and in many ways achieving remarkable results, right? Tanzania achieves universal primary education by the late 70s, such that, you know, it's, I would say it's the fact that many of them, because of the economic and political crisis of the 80s and 90s, went out of practice, that now they're only beginning to rebuild the capacity to make good policy and implement good policy, and get personnel who, you know, mission-driven enough to want to do the same things that policymakers did in the heydays of good policymaking in the region in the 70s.
So, coming back to the question of reforms, they often, of course, are. They can be unpopular, right? The benefits often accrue over time, and probably, I mean, if you're doing the right type of reforms, tend to be more generalized, while the beneficiaries of current arrangements, institutional reforms, tend to be concentrated and sometimes politically powerful. So yeah. What we call vested interests, they can block those reforms. How do you begin the process of thinking about making the case for, I don't know, reform like moving away from generalized fuel subsidies in a place like Nigeria, or you could pick any example?
I think one of the things that we should do is to map out the interests, as you point out, right? Because, you know, as I like to remind my students, you know, saying that there wasn't political will is not a good answer to why policies fail, right? When we design policies, we should account for, you know, pivotal actors who may kill or help specific interventions succeed. So knowing who are the vested interests, who are pro status quo, and then, you know, building coalitions that do not make them feel like they're absolute losers in the process of change. So if you're thinking about fuel subsidies in Nigeria now, right, there's a whole political economy around the fuel subsidies, people who sell generators, the importers of fuel, right? They have to be taken into account, and often, you know, they're a lot bigger of a hindrance to policy change than even the, you know, the general public that would have to pay higher fuel prices. So the backroom negotiations, honest negotiations at that, that would need to take place, I feel like haven't taken place, because often, you know, the prescriptions come with an understanding that, you know, the current behaviors of the said vested interests are suboptimal, and therefore we should just ignore them and focus on the politicians and the general public. But if we took the coalitions around the politicians, many of whom benefit from the status quo, seriously, then, you know, we can begin the elite level frank discussions that are needed to, you know, come up with change processes that are not perfect, but begin the journey in the right direction. And that would also mean accepting second, third best solutions to start with.
So if I may, I want to switch a little bit more to public finance. We are seeing, of course, governments right now being challenged like they haven't in a generation in having to deal with a legacy of, you know, stock of debt issue, and also facing quite a difficult time mobilizing revenues and yet remaining under pressure to continue to spend. These are issues on which you've written quite a bit, so I wanted to ask a couple of questions in this area. You know, again, it's very difficult to generalize, and there's a lot of nuance, of course, but from your perspective, what do you see as the key drivers in bringing countries to the situation that they are? Of course, exogenous factors have played a role, but do you see the reason why debt levels have gone up and we're now facing, you know, larger deficits being primarily excessive spending? Is it an inability, perhaps related to the state capacity issue, to raise more revenues? Or just appetites are just too big. Huh? The governments have to deliver on all the political pressures that they have to face, so they need to run large deficits.
I would say three things that contribute to how we got here with the current debt crisis of sorts. One is that, as you said, right, the region has immense demands, right? The infrastructure gap in the region is, you know, more than $100 billion each year. Countries simply cannot save their way to building the infrastructure they need. So borrowing has to be on the table. Investments in education, right? Free primary education, free secondary education is now a big thing. Universal healthcare is a big thing. So those investments, again, fueled by increasing electoral competition, also put pressure on governments to spend more. Spending more meant borrowing. And then I think because many of the countries, right, they're part of the highly indebted poor countries, debt forgiveness processes of the late 90s, also had a bit of fiscal room, which enabled them to borrow more. And so I think the confluence of those three factors has meant that some governments have found themselves squeezed quite a bit, whereby some of the gambles that they took in investing in infrastructure did not pay off. Some of it because of poor policymaking, projects that were not well thought out, that were not fully intended to be commercially viable, that were perhaps designed for nefarious reasons. But I think, some of it also just because of bad luck, right? They made bets that did not pay off. And I think often we're too harsh on low-income countries when their bets don't pay off, forgetting that, policymakers have to make some bets on big transformational projects. And sometimes those bets don't pay off. And we shouldn't learn the wrong lessons from bets that don't pay off.
If I may, I wanted to drill down into each one of these factors that you highlighted. I mean, something that you write quite a bit about is there's an element of project selection, I guess, maybe not always perhaps selecting the projects with the highest rates of returns. But ex ante, of course, it's difficult to know which projects. That's the point that you're making. But another aspect of it, of course, is that, there are governance issues around some of these projects. What do you think is the balance between these two factors in, say, contributing to spending being not as efficient as it could be?
I mean, I think, I'd begin by saying that when you're poor, right, your margin of error is very slim. I'm reminded that the biggest corruption scandal ever in Malawi was something to the tune of $30 million, right? In a typical American city, that's a rounding error in corruption, right? But because you're Malawi, that's a big deal that sinks President Banda. But that said, right, I think it would be hard for me to say on balance because I see it as a mix in different stages of the project sort of evolution, right? Easy accessibility of loans means that, projects don't go through the requisite scrutiny that they need for us to figure out, what projects are viable or not. The opaqueness of the processes often mean, again, that, we don't know where the money is going. And then, there's also just good faith lack of capacity to do what's needed to efficiently implement projects. So I think net, I would argue that the sort of governance issues tend to be overblown when we think about projects. That this is not to say that it's not important to address those governance issues. But I think I would address those governance issues by focusing more on capacity, right? So that capacity begins to challenge the governance gaps that we see. If the technical team at the transportation ministry in a typical African country can, go head to head with the technical team, say, at a Chinese construction company or bank lending to an African government, then you can begin to have a conversation that, yes, the conversations may account for the governance sort of wastage that's needed to get projects going. But at that point, we're talking about, corruption that greases the wheels versus, sand in the cogs types of corruption. I would take that world any day, as opposed to the current state of affairs.
Very interesting. Drilling into, the revenue side of the challenge that our countries face. In many countries, the challenge, of course, has been that even where projects have been implemented really well, and I think that's on balance the vast majority of cases, governments have not been as good at capturing the rate of return on these projects through the tax system. Why do you see that is? And second, what can be done to address this?
Yeah, so on revenue, right, it's a chicken and egg problem. If the government doesn't do well, you don't have sufficient tax morale for people to pay their taxes, and therefore the government doesn't do well, and therefore tax morale stays diminished. I think solving that sort of fiscal pact question would be key to resolving the revenue issue. Even before we think about, tax mobilization capacities at revenue authorities across the region. And so, you know, I think if governments did a better job of demonstrating good use of taxes, I think there would be more appetite for, you know, tax paying and tax mobilization in the region. Now, you know, most countries are doing better than we would expect, given the capacities and given, you know, the small size of the formal sectors of the economies. But I think overall, it's a problem of governments either not sufficiently convincing the public that their taxes will be used well, or governments intentionally not taxing everyone because they don't want the scrutiny that comes with, you know, broad-based taxation. And I think especially this latter point tends to be ignored, right? We tend to assume that governments always want to tax everyone everywhere. But, you know, most of rural Africa is not taxed. Part of the reason is political, right? The government knows that if you start taxing rural people, they'll want something in return. And if you don't have the capacity to deliver, or if you're not sure you can deliver, or you want to win the next election, then, you know, that's not a fight you want to pick up.
But is this sustainable? Is this durable, given the big challenge that countries are facing? I mean, and how do we make the leap towards broadening the social contract or strengthening the social contract in countries? I mean, I have in mind many countries, but also Kenya comes to mind.
It's definitely not sustainable. I think, you know, one way around this problem would be a process that I've seen in, say, Kenya and Ghana as good examples of this that I've looked at closely. The fiscal space to be able to borrow meant that governments actually did very big things with borrowed funds, which then created demand for similarly big things, which governments then engaged in. Now, both Kenya and Ghana to a large extent, are facing a squeeze right now. But I think moving forward, right, voters will not forget that governments can actually do big things in these two countries. And so that demand for big things, uh-huh, right, will create sort of the beginnings of this fiscal pact, that there's a credible demonstrated capacity to actually be able to do big things, which means that governments, A, because they borrowed in the past, will be forced to tax more to service the debts and create more fiscal space. But in the process, also demonstrate to their voters that, oh yeah, we can actually, you know, build roads, have free secondary education and the like, which voters desperately need right now.
You know, one of the things I've been struck by is, you know, how gloomy, at least outside, sitting in Washington or as we both do, but also elsewhere, really, outside the region, how gloomy the take, the perception is about the region. When I'm in the region, however, I'm struck by the optimism, by the resilience, private sector in particular. How do you explain this? I mean, first, do you agree with this take? I mean, coming, I know, just from Nairobi very recently. And second, how do you explain it, if it's something that you also perceive?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you in the sense that, right, most people want to have a better future, right? And that's reflected in how they cope with the current crisis. And the discourse is often one of how do we get out of this crisis? I think outside the region, right, the horrors of the 80s still loom large in people's minds. And you see it both in academic writing and in the media, right? There's always this fear that African countries will revert back to the bad old days, you know, that long, disastrous decade, 1980 to around 95. And so the fear that things will go back to being as bad as they used to be, I think, makes people quick to run to doom and gloom when they think about the region. So, you know, if you read about the Ghanaian crisis, yes, it's a serious situation that needs quite a bit of reckoning at the political level. But, you know, Ghana is not going to go back to the Ghana of the 80s, right? This time will be different for a whole host of reasons. And so, you know, I'd say that, you know, the policy response at this point shouldn't be to give up. It should be to realize the gains that have been made and do everything possible to protect those gains in preparation for the next big leap after these countries weather the current storm.
Your optimism is one I share also. What do you base this optimism on? When you say Ghana, you know, or other countries facing difficult macroeconomic challenges right now will be moving to another level, is it because you see the level of technological adoption or human capital formation having reached a critical mass? Why can't, you know, the next few governments not make the same policy mistakes that...
Of the past, you mean? I mean, I think, you know, one, we're not going to make the policy mistake of the 80s of blaming government for everything that went wrong, right? I think there's a little bit more open-mindedness about the role of government in the process of economic development, which means that even as we push for fiscal consolidation, we're not going to cut to the bone and weaken the very states that need strengthening at this critical time. I think African countries are also a little bit more diversified than they were in the 80s, which will create some room for slack, which then will allow for resiliency, as you put it, as they weather the current storm. I think it also helps that globally, right, the sort of global best practices are not just coming from one place, Washington, D.C., right? There are multiple points and alternative views around the world and many potential friends that will help different countries weather the storm in different ways. So that, you know, we'll see a lot of policy experimentation. Just over the weekend, Kenya announced this policy experimentation to reduce dollar demand by getting fuel imports on credit from Middle Eastern countries, right? It's not clear whether this will work or not, but it's a nice experiment that is possible now because there are alternative ways of doing things. And just, you know, going back to the age thing, right? In 1980, African countries were 20 years old, and they were hit by, you know, a wrecking ball of a global economic crisis. It shouldn't surprise us that many of them did not do well, right? They're still trying to figure themselves out. 60 years out, they're many of them, you know, strong enough now to figure themselves out and find ways through the current crisis. So that's, you know, those are the basis of my optimism.
Thank you. Very good to know that it's, you know, we're not isolated here at the fund in thinking that the future remains very, very bright and needs to be supported. So wanted to drill into a couple of sectors, maybe start with education. I know this is something that you've written quite a bit about. As much progress has have been made, and I think really staggering when just how much education outcomes have improved in the region overall, there still remains a huge challenge in many parts of the region, particularly the provision of basic education, basic literacy. How do you see the progress in this area? I know there are pockets like Tanzania where there is decent progress, but elsewhere, you know, the challenge remains really profound.
Yeah, I mean, I think education is one of those big policy questions that, you know, impacts every household, and so it's front and center on politicians' minds. And the way I see education right now is the universal primary education push, which was part of the Millennium Development Goals, was a noble effort. Unfortunately, for some reason, policymakers did not think that, you know, if you get kids through primary school, there's going to be demand for secondary schools and universities. So the current political question on education is free secondary education, right? It's in Ghana, it's in Kenya, Uganda, Zambia, Tanzania, which is leading to overcrowding in high schools as much as we saw in the early 2000s with primary schools. There's also the question of higher education and the funding of higher education. And then globally, the focus is on learning outcomes as opposed to sort of increasing access in a sustainable manner. And these things then create tension within governments and their policymaking processes. How do you cater to the global push to improve learning outcomes at all costs, right? So, you know, you have global policy experts who will say that, you know, the bamboo schools in Niamey are enough to produce good learning outcomes, right? And they don't want to listen to the fact that politicians want to build, you know, concrete schools because they want to show that, you know, they're modernizing the education system. And so I think in overall, right, I would say that human capital development has improved. More people are going through schools. That this, some of the good schools on the continent are doing well. We see that in, you know, African students who then go overseas and do very well at top universities across the world. At the same time, though, there's a risk that increasing access without paying close attention to quality will lead to too much dilution. And I think there's a bit of a mismatch between what politicians want and what sort of global education experts want. And I keep highlighting global experts because, you know, they tend to have quite a bit of influence on governments in terms of what governments prioritize, right? It would have been great if African governments would move at their own pace in expanding access, investing in schools, designing their own curriculums that pay attention to social and political contexts, so that education becomes what it is everywhere, which is a social thing. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Very interesting. So you mentioned the influence of international experts. I mean, what is the lesson that international experts have to learn? You know, what is it that we could do better to try and internalize the, you know, deeply local, deeply domestic nature of processes like this?
I think, you know, it's that education is not just about test scores and producing human capital, right? It's deeply embedded in social struggles and conflicts. And that, you know, to have a good education system that actually produces good learning outcomes and high quality human capital, you need to pay attention to the other functions of education that society wants. Political sort of indoctrination or education, civics education, social formation, and all these things. So I'd say, you know, being a bit more humble and leaning a lot more on domestic voices rather than top-down sort of templates for reform would be the way to go. Going back to sort of the reform point, right, I think if I could pick one sector that's been worst affected by reformities, it's education in the region. Just too many reforms and programs all the time without really much to show for it.
I mean, so what is it that makes education susceptible to this relative to other areas? Or is it your perception that all the other areas are also susceptible to this same problem? And what is it that governments can do to minimize this?
Yeah, I mean, I think education is a bit more susceptible because the stakeholders in education, right, there's this sort of weird match between parents demanding high-quality education now and governments' desire to signal that they're doing something about it. So because it impacts every household and government's desire to signal that they're doing something about it means that, you know, they'll always try something new. In most countries, right, education is the biggest expenditure item on government budgets. And so there's a need to signal that, oh, we're doing something about this problem. And often, you know, doing something means doing something new as opposed to strengthening what exists to make it better.
One of the things that I've been struck by on education is just how much people are willing to pay for better quality education out of pocket. The model we have in the region, however, now is, you know, the government paying for everything and kind of ignoring or looking askance at the private education sector. Are we missing a trick here? Are we missing, a way in which there can be perhaps, you know, both private and public could be providing better education services jointly in the region?
I think you're spot on here that, you know, the model should be a mixed model. And, you know, Kenya to some extent demonstrated this, in the 60s, 80s, where the government had pretty high performing public schools, which in many ways are still the best schools in the country. There's a vibrant private sector and then a lower tier public education system, often overcrowded, often not so well run. But, you know, this tiered system meant that, you know, a lot of what used to be district and provincial schools in Kenya in the 80s and 90s have actually over the years improved so much that they now compete with the national schools. Mm-hmm. And it may not be politically palatable or sound good for, you know, experts in the sector to imagine, you know, deliberate tiered system. But, you know, it one of the usefulness of a system where there's the multiple options is that you can learn from the multiple options on how to be a good school in a context like Kenya. Instead of always imagining that, you know, you can change the whole system at once. This sort of gradual system, perhaps, you know, for political reasons, you could do again what Kenya did, which is have a quota system so that the best schools get kids from all over the country as a way of buying political support for the tiered system. I think that would be a practical way to approach the problem rather than imagining that, you know, you'll have 30,000 great schools all at once.
Fascinating, fascinating. So, shifting gears to a little bit more external developments, in one of your recent blog posts, you talked quite a bit about the changing external power structure facing the region, the rise of geopolitical tensions. You know, they've been there for a while, but, you know, they're coming into quite an acute relief in parts now, right? And what implications this may have for countries. Now, earlier you said you painted a fairly benign picture that the region can remain non-aligned and, you know, exploit this period of heightened fragmentation. But isn't there also a risk, though, that we revert back to the dreaded 1980s when, you know, countries were pushed into aligning themselves with one part or another, and the effect of that was to coddle them rather than pursue what's in the best interest of their people, eh? I mean, by relying on one power or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think the risk that you highlight is real, you know, but I think what's different now is that the demand from below is fairly strong, a lot stronger than it was in the 80s, right? So the mix of global competition and domestic electoral demands. And, you know, I can't stress this enough. This is true in both electoral democracies, but also in the electoral authoritarian states. It will mean that how elites engage with the global powers will be, you know, with one eye on global geopolitics and another eye on domestic politics. So to the extent that elites are facing these two pressures, I think this time will be a little bit different. And, you know, if you look at, say, you know, Zambia and Kenya as good examples, right? On the electoral democracy front, they've been very open to Western suggestions and recommendations for electoral democratic reforms. Those reforms have created enormous demand on ruling elites who've looked to China to get loans to meet the electoral demands, right? So, you know, I think this is a dynamic that is playing out in the region such that, you know, if you're sitting in at the State Department here in D.C. and wanting countries to be democratic, if you succeed at your efforts but don't avail financing for projects and other things that elections will create demands for, guess what? They'll go looking for where that money is easily available. And right now, you know, borrowing in China is a good and quick way for governments to get projects done within electoral business cycles. They don't have to wait for, you know, a six-year feasibility study by the World Bank, not to malign your sister institution here, right? They can get railways built on time ahead of the next election by getting loans from China.
Last question, Ken, and perhaps the most important one. I often feel that the unfolding demographic story in Africa, as we speak, is one of the most overlooked stories in global economics, global politics, you know, in terms of how it's going to shape the future of our world over the next 30, 40, 50 years, from many angles. One, I mean, this is where the future global labor force is coming into being in terms of, you know, the incremental effects on things like climate change, etc. This is the region that's going to have the most impact. I mean, yes, maybe that China and India are the biggest polluters and, of course, the industrialized countries, but going forward, you know, both in terms of the effects of climate change, but also marginal contribution to global warming, unless we adopt the right technologies, that's where it's going to all happen. But this tends to be overlooked. I would love to hear your take on, one, if you agree if these demographic issues that are ongoing in the region are important, and on a global scale, and then second, what it is that we can do to bring more attention to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're spot on, right? I wrote a post titled 3 Billion Africans, right? In our lifetime, if we get to live long enough, right, we'll live in a world where there are 3 billion Africans. What does that mean? It means a lot more people in urban areas demanding jobs and better government performance, a lot more African immigrants outside of the region, more demand on governments to do more. And so and also potential to shape global geopolitics, right? And Nigeria with, you know, 400 million people, or Ethiopia with 150 million people looks very different than the countries that we see today. So I think this is a big story that more people should be paying attention to. And I think, you know, the challenge moving forward, right, is can African countries develop quickly enough to make sure that, you know, in the coming years, right, we don't just have 3 billion stomachs, but we have 3 million well-trained people and brains to power the next phase of African development. I think that's the tension that sort of I think about when I think about the demographic trends in the region. Will there be sufficient investment in the human capital so that we get 3 billion brains, or are we going to just have 3 billion stomachs to take care of, right? Governments should think seriously about these twin challenges. If we go the stomachs route, right, there'll be a lot of crises, food crises and all that. Now, you know, how do we get more people to pay attention to this? I think, you know, it'll be forced on them, right? Kind of like how now American foreign policy and European foreign policy are quickly adjusting to the geopolitical relevance of the region, having seen what other major and middle powers are able to do in the region. I think anyone who doesn't pay attention now will be shocked, you know, when suddenly there are 3 billion Africans with, you know, 60 million in the diaspora, forcing the issue of the region's importance on the global stage. Not to mention things about climate change, jobs, markets, and all that.
I mean, what's a bit worrisome is that this fierce urgency of needing to invest in the region now, support the region now, given exactly the workforce of the coming years is needing to be educated now, is lacking, is missing. And that's why I was saying kind of the importance of needing to bring attention to this issue. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think any outsider who wants to have friends in the region moving forward, right, should have the foresight to invest in the region's human capital of the future today so that you lock in the friendliness and ties, right? I still, even with, you know, the looming enormous demand, right, I'm still optimistic that the trends in human capital development are good enough. They're not great, but they're good enough. African universities are getting better, and to the extent that they're not able to absorb everyone, you know, there's been an explosion of African students moving out of the region. China now has more students than the US. Those engineers will come back to the region to do big things. So similarly, you know, Turkey has become a major business partner. Maybe Turkish universities may be able to absorb a lot more African students. So I see there being enough of an opportunity to invest in human capital that's just good enough to keep the region moving, even as it faces this enormous demographic gap. But it would be great if we were a bit more serious and deliberate in cultivating the human capital of the future, knowing, you know, the demographic trends.
Indeed. Ken, I cannot thank you enough for these incredibly insightful views. We usually do this bilaterally, so it's good to be able to you know, share your deep and profound insights with a broader audience. Thank you so much for coming, and look forward to continuing our conversations. I hope to have you back one of these days soon. Eh?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and yeah, keep the optimistic flame alive, please.
Absolutely. It will happen. This is the African century.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
That was Georgetown University School of Foreign Service Professor Ken Opalo and IMF African Department Head Abebe Amro Selassie in a conversation that took place as part of the Africa Perspective series hosted by that same department. Look for it at imf.org. Ken Opalo's book is called Legislative Development in Africa and published by Cambridge University Press. Look for other IMF podcasts on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.